Professor Kowalski received his BA in mathematics from the University of Bridgeport in 1963. After that, he received a master's in science in mathematics from Stanford University and ultimately received a PhD in computer science from the University of Edinburgh in 1970. His work covers artificial intelligence and computer logic. He's won numerous awards, including the IJCAI Research Excellence Award in 2011, and he has associations with, among others, the American Association for Artificial Intelligence, which I understand has now changed its name, the European Coordinating Committee for Artificial Intelligence, and the Association for Computing Machinery. He's now Emeritus Professor at Imperial College London, and today he'll be giving a talk entitled Computational Logic for Artificial and Human Intelligence.
Well, this is so exciting for me to be back since 1959, my first return, and especially to the college society, which is so fantastic because it's the students who have invited me, which is even more important than had it been some distinguished group of Nobel Prize committee. Thank you very much. So my talk could have been the meaning of life from a technological point of view. I'll try to explain in more detail. So what is the relevance to this particular meeting? Well, the relevance is that the same technologies that humans use in order to be intelligent have also been applied to make computers more intelligent. But why should computers have all the fun? Why should robots have all the fun? Why can't we, too, benefit from some of the things we've learned about how to make machines intelligent so we can be more intelligent ourselves? As Evan mentioned, I was a student here in 1959, it's great to be back. It's great to be back because I was a failure at the end of my first year. I failed my English writing skills course. I've spent much of my career trying to understand what was wrong with my use of English, and is there any way I could improve that? And you'll be the judge as to whether or not what I say today is in any way makes sense. In particular, not only did I learn what I didn't know, I also learned the solution to my problem coming from my mathematics course, because I had an introduction to mathematical logic, which I then connected to my failure in the English writing skills course. And when you put the two together, you get artificial intelligence as experienced by some human beings. I'll be covering a lot of ground in the same way that the core at the University of Chicago covers a great deal of ground, and I'll be looking at a number of passages from these books. So, what is it that a human being, what is it that a machine is designed to do? It's designed to make its goals come true, to achieve its goals in the face of challenges, threats, opportunities that arise in the world around it. We observe these threats, and we have beliefs about what those threats actually mean and how they affect our goals, and we use our same beliefs, perhaps in a different way, in order to see what we can do to change the world to make it conform better to our needs and our goals. This is the theme of my talk, that life, the meaning of life, whether it be the meaning of life for a machine or the meaning of life for a human person, organization, or individual, is to achieve goals using beliefs which hopefully are true, and the more true they are, the more likely they are to lead to the fulfillment of our goals. You may have noticed that there's a hidden pyramid here. There's a very nice book which I discovered very late in my career called The Pyramid Principle by Barbara Minto, Logical Writing, Thinking, and Problem Solving. A book written not for an academic audience, but for people who wanted to make a success in a business career. This is written by a business lady for business people. So the summary of my talk is that life is all about achieving goals, using beliefs, and if those beliefs are true, you're more likely to satisfy your goals. But from a technical point of view, what structure do our goals have? What structure do our beliefs have? Now, there is a system developed by computer scientists and cognitive scientists called production rules, production systems, which come close to formalizing what we mean by our goals. There is also a system, many systems, using logic, which are designed to formalize and represent human beliefs, and also beliefs of the kind that can be incorporated into computer machinery. And they are definitely in logical form, and in particular the form of logic programs, programs written in logic that can be executed either by machines or by people. First of all, production systems. These production rules which represent human goals, which can also be used to implement computer goals. There's a very famous Nobel scholar, Herbert Simon, who received the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on limited rationality and in particular as an advocate of production systems and production rules. For Herbert Simon, production rules are computer languages which have this very simple form. If certain conditions hold in the world, then perform certain actions, presumably in order to achieve some satisfactory state of affairs. For example, suppose there's a fire. What should you do? So the condition that arises in the world, you observe a fire. What should you do? Well, you can eliminate the fire. Well, you can escape. Well, maybe you can't do both at the same time. So this arrow, which looks like logic, if conditions then action, isn't logic at all, because typically you cannot eliminate and escape at the same time. In logic, instead, we would represent the same goal as saying for all times, if there's a fire at a particular point in time, then you eliminate that fire, let's say at the next point in time, or not and, because here the logic is not there, or you escape, let's say, at the next point in time. So you have a chance to try to eliminate the threat, the fire, and if you fail, you still have an opportunity, say one moment of time later, to escape from that fire. And here the arrow does truly represent logical if and then. So what I'm selling to you today is the idea that logic can be used to program computers, can be used to represent human goals, and also human beliefs. So far, we're only looking at goals. Suppose now we have an agent represented by this sun-like object embedded in a world, very blue sky as we have outside today. And we have a goal, which is that for all times T, if there's a fire, then eliminate it or escape. Suppose indeed there is a fire at time one. Then in order to satisfy this goal, the agent, be it a computer or be it a human, the agent must try to make the conclusion true. Either eliminate that fire or escape. Suppose the agent attempts to eliminate the fire, but this fails. Then the agent still has time to escape, and with luck, that will succeed. And if that's the case, then on this particular instant of time, time one, the agent has managed to make this goal true by not eliminating the threat at time two, but rather by escaping at time three. But then time goes on. To achieve or to make the agent's goal true, this must be true for all time. So we must see what happens at the next point in time and the next point in time, and time potentially goes on forever. So in this view of logic, whether it be the logic of a machine or the logic of a human machine, in this view of logic, the purpose of life, the meaning of life, is to make one's goals true by performing actions to change the world in the light of challenges that might be either threats or opportunities. The goal is to be made true. And here, the notion of truth does indeed mean truth in the logical sense of the word. So I now want to turn my attention to beliefs and how our beliefs differ from goals. Typical goals that we've seen have the form of, when expressed logically, where this arrow now means a logical if and then, they have the form of some conditions that should be evaluated in the world, and then some alternative conclusions which we want to hold true. And typically this must be for all time. There exist times in the future. But what about our beliefs? Beliefs are programs that have a form, which also is logical. This arrow is also if and then. I like to write it as a convention the other way around. And it's that a conclusion will hold if certain conditions hold. Now let me illustrate that. But bear in mind, it can be very hard to tell the difference. And much of the history, the recent and current history of my subject, both the subject of logic, the subject of artificial intelligence, the subject of computing, is still in the state of the art totally confused about this relationship between this arrow, and the arrow of production systems, which is not the arrow of logic. In particular, this very popular author, Poisoner of Young Minds, who has written this Introduction to Cognitive Science, says that unlike logic, production rules can easily represent strategic information about what to do. So remember, production rules are the most influential model of human thinking that is currently accepted by cognitive scientists. And Paul Thagard is a great admirer of production systems and is rather critical of logic itself. And here is his example. He says, if you want to go home, this is written to be popular with students. He caters to students. So if you want to go home for the weekend and you have the bus fare, then you can catch a bus. He maintains this cannot be expressed easily or at all in logic. And so this if and then, which you see here, is not logical if and then. It's the if and then of production rules of Herbert Simon's Introduction to Production Systems. I now want to contrast that with another approach to rule-based programming, which represents beliefs, because remember, we've only looked at goals so far, which looks at beliefs which also have logical form. In fact, beliefs which are programs to be executed by people. So look at this sign from the London Underground. In case there's an emergency, press the alarm signal button to alert the driver. That sounds a bit like a strategy. If you want to alert the driver, press the alarm signal button. According to Thagard, this cannot easily be represented in logical form. On the other hand, the other two sentences are very directly in logic. The driver will stop, that's a conclusion. If any part of the train is in a station, that's a condition. That is pure logic. And similarly here, the third sentence is purely logical. If not any part of the train is in a station, the train will continue to the next station. And why? Because help can be more easily given in a station than it can be given when the train is not in a station. And finally, and perhaps most interestingly, there's a £50 penalty for improper use. I want to argue that although the second and third sentences are obviously logical, they're not goals, they're rather beliefs. Because it may not be true that the driver will stop the train. It may not be true that help could be more easily given than this. These are beliefs, which are programs to be executed by the driver of the train, maybe. On the other hand, the first sentence is a program written in the imperative mode, in the way that conventional programming languages works, but also designed to be executed by a human being. And finally, there's this very interesting, curious last sentence. So the second and third sentences are totally unproblematic, and I won't waste any more time on them. But it is worth saying that the typical intended use of these sentences is to allow you, as a passenger on the underground, if there is an emergency, to derive possible consequences of what would happen if you alert the driver. So this helps you to make a decision. There's an emergency. Shall I press the alarm signal button? And if I do, what will happen? And do I like what will happen? Is the utility positive or negative? So this fits in very well with theories of rationality, forward reasoning. And I'll be talking a lot about forward and backward reasoning. So what about this first sentence? What about this sentence that Thagard would say cannot easily be expressed in logical form? It's a strategy, if you want to alert the driver, press the alarm signal button. I maintain that that can naturally be expressed as a logic program, as a belief which says that you alert the driver if you press the alarm signal button. The conclusion that the driver is alerted follows from the condition that you press the alarm signal button. But here the intended use is backwards. Use this not in order to derive what will happen if you press the alarm signal button, namely the driver will be alerted, but rather in a situation where you have a goal to alert the driver, you should generate the sub-goal of pressing the alarm signal button. So forward reasoning contrasts with backward reasoning. And it's this combination of backward reasoning with logic programs of this form that turn logic into a programming language that can be used for computers, but also into a programming language that can be used by people. Most interestingly is this last sentence. There is a 50-pound penalty for improper use. What's the logic to this? It's a hidden logic, sure enough. But again, it's a logic program this time. There is a belief that you may receive a 50-pound penalty if you use the alarm signal button improperly. But the intention here is not that you should use this backwards to see how you can go about getting a 50-pound penalty, but rather that you should use it forwards to derive the logical consequences of your possibly using the alarm signal button when you're not supposed to do so. You may receive a 50-pound penalty, and the utility of that is not very high. So it might help you to decide not to press the alarm signal button if you might, as a consequence, get a 50-pound penalty. The intention, therefore, when we write the logic in this form, is to use this in a forward direction to help you evaluate the consequences of possibly pressing the alarm signal button. But, of course, we could have used it backwards, as part of a program to receive a 50-pound penalty for fun by pressing the alarm signal button improperly. So let's see how this applies to Thagard's example of a strategy that cannot be represented in logical form. If you want to go home and you have the bus fare, then you can catch a bus. Well, the underlying logic, the hidden logic, is you will go home if you have the bus fare and you catch the bus. And the hidden intention is that you should use this to reason backwards, not to reason forwards. Sherlock Holmes understood this a long time ago, long before Thagard, long before logic programming was invented. He said to his faithful sidekick, Dr. Watson, in solving a problem of this sort, the great thing is to be able to reason backwards. That's very useful, very easy, but people don't do it. And Thagard certainly never learned how to do it. And he's teaching young minds not to do it either. In the everyday affairs of life, and he's right about this, again, Sherlock Holmes knew it, it's more useful to reason forwards, because that's what animals do. That's what primitive life forms do. At the basic level, we all and only reason forwards from the current state of affairs to what we're going to do next. In everyday life, we are reactive animals. And it's more useful because that's what we've been evolved to do. Through millions of years of evolution, we have learned how to react to the situation around us in order, on the average, to achieve some implicit, unstated, higher-level goal. So the other comes either not to be developed or to be neglected. So here we see that same agent who wants to make its goals true in the world in the face of changes that take place continuously, observing those changes and using its beliefs to analyze what those changes mean to see if they affect the agent's goals, and then to use those same beliefs or other beliefs in a backward manner to reduce its goals to sub-goals. So, for example, suppose at time one, an agent observes that there is a fire. But now this agent is more intelligent than the previous agent because it has a notion of abstraction. It has abstracted from this more concrete fire the more abstract notion that there is some kind of threat. Whereas before we had, if there is a fire, then eliminate it or escape, we now have this more general goal of whenever there is a threat of any kind and the fire is one kind of threat, then we should eliminate it or escape. And we do that by reasoning forwards, reasoning forwards to derive consequences, logical consequences of our experience. And this may well happen at the subconscious level or the conscious level. When we implement these in computers, it's very hard to tell whether what we're designing and what we're implementing is actually the mind of a conscious or the mind of a subconscious agent. It's very, very hard to tell the difference. And now we can have other beliefs. One way to eliminate a threat is to get help. There are other ways too. You can do it yourself or something else. And there may be many ways to get help. Just shout out loud. But in particular, you could press the alarm signal button if you believe what you read on the emergency notice. And you can reason backwards. To reduce the goal of eliminating the threat, you reduce it to the more concrete sub-goal of getting help, and you reduce the intermediately abstract notion of getting help to the more concrete notion of getting help until you finally reduce it to something which can be done at a primitive level. And then you perform that action, or you hope to perform that action, you try to perform that action, and you may succeed or fail. If you succeed, you're done at this particular point of time. If you fail, you might be lucky, and you might have other options available to you. So in addition, you may have there could be many ways to make a goal true. So when we have goals, we have options. We have many alternatives. And the more beliefs we have, the more options we have. The more knowledge we have, the more options we have. So knowledge makes us more capable and more able to deal with the challenges of the world. There could be many ways to get help. And notice that if you ignore the symbolic detail, what you've got is a connectionist network. You've got connections that link the agent to the to its sensations of changes in the world into some abstract network, which you may or may not be able to express in natural language or in symbolic form, and then reduce them to actions. And indeed, those connections could have weights. And those weights can help you. Those weights can help you to decide, well, shall I try this or shall I try that? Those weights may have to do with frequency of previous experiences. So logic is compatible with many other approaches, connectionist approaches, probabilistic approaches, decision theory. And in particular, Jonathan Baron, who's written another textbook, a good textbook this time, I'm pretty pleased to say, but not a textbook that is fully informed, because no one is fully informed, the subject is just so vast, says that in thinking, because he distinguishes thinking from deciding, in thinking about actions, beliefs, or goals, it can be described in terms of a common framework. And that's what we need, a common framework. We don't want this Tower of Babel where everyone speaks in a different voice and everybody says, I can do what you can't do what I do, blah, 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 blah. No, we need a common framework. So Baron is absolutely right. And his common framework is an approximation to what I'm trying to sell you today. He says the common framework asserts that all kinds of thinking involves search and inference. Okay, inference is logic, basically forward reasoning. But search, for Baron, isn't logic. He says we search for certain objects and then we make inferences from and about those objects. And of course, we use the conclusions, evaluate the utility, if you like, and help us to decide what to do. So then we decide. And how does that look? So when we search, we may not realize it, but we're probably doing backward reasoning. We're reasoning from our goal and looking at the alternative. We're searching. And when we find a candidate solution, we evaluate by forward reasoning its consequences. And we look at those alternative consequences and then we decide. Let's see how all of this applies to the famous Turing test, to decide whether or not a robot can fool Turing into believing that the robot is actually human. So here's the Turing test goal. When Turing says a sentence starting at time t1 and ending at time t2, then there should exist future times t3 and 4 so that the robot says the sentence in return, starting after Turing is finished, starting at time 3 after Turing is finished, and ending, but not later than 3 seconds after Turing is finished. So there's a time limit. And suppose Turing says at time 1 to 2, what, then says is, then says your name. It's a question. Turing is asking the robot, what is your name? So the robot needs to bridge the gap between the sentences, the words that it observes, suppose these are primitive observations, and its more abstract concepts. It's more abstract concepts of sentences, which involve noun phrases, verb phrases. And then it can be naturally expressed as logic programs. So the formal grammars that linguists have devised are basically sentences of logic, which say, for example, if any agent, whether it be Turing or the robot, says a sentence starting at time t1 and ending at time t3, that sentence is expressed. If first the agent says a noun phrase and then the agent says a verb phrase. So one way to have a sentence is to say a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. And there are, let's say, in this example, two ways to have a noun phrase. A noun phrase is an adjective followed by a noun, or a noun phrase is a noun. Two ways. There are many ways, of course. This is a very simplified example. This is the kind of program that's embedded in Watson, which understands natural language sentences. And it was developed by a team involving Prolog programs that included people working on such logic programs. A verb phrase might be, for example, a verb followed by a noun phrase. Adjective, and then now we have some classification of individual words. If any agent says the word my, then the agent has said an adjective. And similarly, we have now a lexicon, as a linguist would call it. We have a lexicon. Name is a noun, Bob is a noun, what is another noun, is a verb. So what did Turing say? Turing said, what is your name? And what does the robot say? In order to achieve its goal on this particular occasion, the robot might say, my name is Bob. Robot, Bob, same thing. This action at this particular point in time makes the goal true. But the goal must be made true for all times. For all times. But in doing so, the agent reasons forwards from what it observes. It observes Turing saying some sentences, and it's got to fill the pyramid, which says, and recognize, therefore, that Turing has said a sentence. And there's two ways to do it. You can fill the pyramid bottom-up or forwards. Or if you're trying to generate a sentence, you can fill it top-down or backwards. So the same grammar, the same logical belief can be used backwards or forwards. And of course, linguists have invented very sophisticated algorithms, almost all of which, for linguists, for grammar, all of which are special cases of logical reasoning. Much more general than linguists would like to admit. Chomsky himself says that our language capacity is very domain-specific. It's absolutely false. Our language capacity is a special case of forward and backward reasoning. Suppose, for example, Turing now tries to outsmart the robot and says, on another occasion, my name is Bob, trying to trick the robot. Well, what does the robot do? The robot might, for example, produce another sentence and play games with Turing and say, what is your name? If you can ask the question, I can ask the question too. But there could be many ways. There could be many ways to make the same goals true, and the robot could instead say, what is your Bob? Because according to the grammar I've written, Bob is a noun, and it doesn't matter whether we have a noun name or a name or a noun Bob. What's the utility? So how do we decide? We evaluate the consequences. We determine the probability, blah, blah, blah. So it's back to the pyramid principle. Parsing language is filling in a pyramid, top down or bottom up. But basically, if you want to be coherent, if you want to be coherent, and hear my favorite author on English writing style, the one I read who rescued me from my D in English, from the University of Chicago, by the way, this is University of Chicago, famous professor. Two principles of coherence. Put at the beginning of a sentence, ideas that are already mentioned, referred to implied, concepts you can reasonably expect that your reader is already familiar with or will recognize. At the end of the sentence, what do? You put the newest, most surprising, most significant, the information you want to stress, perhaps the information you will expand upon in the next sentence. Well, that's just logic. What I was missing in my English course was logic. I couldn't express myself unambiguously, clearly, coherently. And as I improved, I learned that what was missing was logic. One way is to, of course, to use forward reasoning. Well, A is the case, but if A, then B. A is familiar to you now. B may not have been familiar, but I've just told you about it. Now that B is familiar, C is something new that I can take you to where I always wanted you to go. But for the most part, it's better to present your information backwards. What do I want to convince you of? I want to convince you of C. But did you know that C if B, B if A, and A, therefore, C? This is just a connectionist network in the mind of an agent, and it can be structured and presented and used in many different ways, forwards or backwards. So what did I learn from the University of Chicago core? That the same tools of inquiry are used in every discipline, in English, in mathematics, in science, in technology. The same tools, the same technology, the technology of logic, backward and forward reasoning, making goals true, using beliefs which may or may not be true, which may be inadequate, evaluating the consequences of proposed courses of actions. These are common to every field, be it the humanities, the sciences, or technology. So I rest my case. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the talk. I thought I heard you say that you disagree with Chomsky about his notion of grammar. Could you please expand on that?
I know. No, Chomsky's view is that grammar is innate, but it's a specialized module. Our understanding of natural language, more generally, Chomsky argues that our understanding of natural language is not part of a general purpose mechanism, that it's a specialized mechanism. And I think I've just demonstrated that he's wrong. I believe I've demonstrated that he's wrong.
I was at a conference recently that Helen Caldicott recently held in New York on the possibility of nuclear extinction demise because of the role of artificial intelligence being given the authority to control the nuclear deterrent, and whether or not it becomes so complex that the machines take on their own in analyzing the goal, deterrent, and deterrent has to be backed up by actual use, otherwise there is no deterrent, analyze the incoming threats as perceived, and decide to launch on a mistaken indication, as has happened numerous times in the past. However, there have been humans that have intervened and gone against protocol. Machines have a protocol. Can you address that as perhaps you're aware of this issue? Stephen Hawking and some fellow up at MIT have wrote a paper on it that stimulated her. Thank you.
That's a very good, great question. The current technology in artificial intelligence, as in most fields, is very fragmented. So there are many competing theories of how to create an artificial intelligence. And many of these theories use technologies which are not human-friendly. They're not like human technologies. It's like the plane that flies without flapping its wings. It's not an animal-like technology. And to interact with such machines that are helping us to make decisions becomes risky and very difficult because they're not like us. So what we need is a common ground between those artificially intelligent machines and our human intellects so that we can communicate and argue and debate and we can exchange beliefs. So if the machine says you should drop the bomb because it's then speaking our language, but we can ultimately then be in control. At the moment, with many computers and with many artificially intelligent systems, they don't speak our language. They don't think like us. We can't argue with them. We can't be sure to be in control. So I'm advocating a technology which can be used by humans and by machines where we can understand one another, where we can have the last say, where they can help to educate us, where they're not so intelligent in such a way that is inscrutable to us, that we have to make a decision whether to let them go ahead and decide on our behalf. So I agree with you. There is a danger with current technologies, and I'm hoping that what I'm proposing could help to address that. But ultimately, the humans should be in charge, because basically these machines are for our benefit. We humans are not there for the benefit of machines. Let's not get confused about that.
So I have a kind of a two-part question. It kind of relates to the way that we've kind of made artificial intelligence. So they're designed by humans. But the thing that's I find kind of interesting about artificial intelligence, or one of them, is that they make their own, they learn their own things over time. And so they can form their own beliefs that human beings may not have programmed into them. They can form, if you view, for example, their way that they process, you know, the way that you process logic, what you think are the next steps to follow as a belief, they may form beliefs about that as well. And so for me, there's kind of this two-part question. The first thing is, since we've designed machines, is there a way for them to have a very different way of approaching problems than human beings, slash get past the limitations of human beings? The second thing is, since human beings are designing artificial intelligences, are they always going to think in the same way that we do? Or is there a possibility that they will have a different approach to problems than human beings?
Okay, I think both questions are good and hopefully addressed in the approach I've proposed. So I haven't discussed learning at all, but basically machines using goals and beliefs can learn new beliefs based upon analyzing patterns in their experience. If these beliefs are expressed in logical human-like form, we can understand those beliefs. So there are approaches to machine learning which produce unintelligible knowledge that can be used by machines, which humans will have difficulty assessing. Moreover, because beliefs can be expressed in logical form, if they are expressed in that manner, we can assess them for truth. So machines may be able to discover new truths that we human beings have not yet uncovered. They can tell us, they don't have to keep it to themselves, they can tell us what those new truths are, and they can, and we can all use those truths, whether the machine uses them to reach an option for a way of solving a problem, or whether it tells us this belief, this is true, according to the experience I've accumulated, I haven't found any exceptions, or if I have, it's true, it covers 99% of my experience, and there are some singularities maybe that aren't, so beware, but nonetheless, on the whole, a belief can be expressed in this logical form, and it can be communicated to us. We can decide whether or not we want the machine to take autonomous use of that, or whether we want to interact with it. So I think, yes, machines can discover things, and it's going to happen a lot. By mining data from the web, it will discover lots of things that we don't know. It'll discover lots of common sense, but it should be able to communicate that to us, and we should be able to authorize it to use that in particular ways, but we should also be able to prevent it if we want to do so. I think that's my answer.
Can you conceive of these systems that you're talking about evolving having a moral and ethical code and compassion the way that human beings normally do? And if they're designed by sociopaths, of whom there are many in the society, will they be sociopathic also?
Absolutely. There's every possibility that machines could have goals that are not only personal to the machine, shall we say, but personal to the constructor of the machine, constructor of the artificially intelligent system. That constructor, that designer, might have malicious, very selfish goals. And if that machine is totally under the control of its designer, then anything can happen. That is unavoidable. So basically, these artificially intelligent machines are, I would say, the agents of their creators. The creator might say, I didn't program it to do this, I didn't program it to do that, because it learned about this, it learned about that, and it decided this versus that. But I personally maintain it was the designer who did not incorporate safeguards, the designer who imbued it with the personal selfish goals of the designer itself as opposed to the goals of other agents in society. So yeah, there's a real hazard there. As we know, you know, many of our computing students go on to do bad things. They do bad things. And it's going to happen with artificial intelligence, even those designed according to principles I've described, because the goals need not be altruistic goals, need not be for the benefit of mankind, personkind as a whole. Which is why we should be able to read the goals and read the beliefs of these agents, and we should be able to evaluate whether those goals are sufficiently altruistic or neutral or objective and not overly selfish and malicious. And if these agents are programmed in mechanisms and languages which are not like ones that humans understand, then I don't think we're headed in a very good direction at all. And computing, I think, is in a horrible state of affairs from that point of view. The languages developed in computing today are a Tower of Babel. Different languages for programming, different languages for databases, different languages for AI. Everyone's a specialist. None of these languages are intelligible to ordinary people. Yes, we're on a bad path if we continue the way we are. Thank you for warning us.
So I don't consider myself an expert in, certainly not in artificial intelligence or machine learning, but my impression of where the field is going is I don't consider those machines really intelligent, but what I, in some way fear is that more and more of these rules and options are going to be hard-coded more and more. Some might be hard-coded, some might be inferred, right? But I think what's happening these days is more and more programmers put more and more of these rules into these systems, right? Up to the point where the machine has all the options we would have, right? Let's say, and by options I mean what you said, right? Like pressing the button or by adding more and more of these options, we make them in some way intelligent, right? So I just wanted to stress that I don't consider them as really intelligent, but as we add more options, they become so powerful, right? And speaking of what the gentleman mentioned before, in case they are connected to, let's say, atomic control systems, right? I mean, probably some in the room said, well, I can just pull the plug, right? But it's not that easy. Already when I go home to my apartment, right, my mobile already automatically connects to my router, right? And if I turn off the router, it will connect to another one, which is close by, right? So try to keep the system alive, right? So I agree to some extent that this, some people might think this is not a possible danger, but it might actually not be as impossible, right? Because some similar things are happening now. The system is trying to keep itself alive. And that's just a remark, right?
I completely agree. And with all the data on the web in particular and with machine learning techniques, some of them do use logic-based techniques in particular. With machine learning techniques, the knowledge that these machines will soon have, and with that knowledge goes capabilities to recognize situations that we humans would miss that are relevant to our well-being. And also, along with that knowledge, that's using the knowledge in a forward fashion to abstract away from the concrete detail and see that it's relevant to our goals. And then along with that vast knowledge would also be alternative and novel ways, novel ways of accomplishing our goals from the conclusions. And no one person will be able to understand all of that knowledge. It'll be so vast. In the same way that Watson beat the game of Jeopardy, the knowledge available to Watson was so far beyond that available to any human. But that knowledge is not coded in logical, purely logical, human intelligible form. But even if and when it is, it'll be beyond any one person to bring all that knowledge together and apply it when it's relevant. So it'll be absolutely essential that we have ways of interacting with these systems when it truly counts. Otherwise, we won't be able to turn the machine off. As you say, it'll be somewhere in the cloud and it'll come back to haunt us.
Just to mention, coming back to the question of how to restrict machines, right? We should do it. So the thing is, machines are only going to be a threat if they have an interface, right? If they can interact with sensors, right? And let's say they're connected to a nuclear plant, right? Once they are connected to some mechanical things, right? Like launching a rocket, etc. That's where we have to have the boundary, right? That we are still able to pull the plug or stop the system, right? That's where we should put the boundary, right? Because ultimately, they're not as powerful. If it's just a computer, a laptop is harmless, right? But if it's connected, as I said, to a nuclear power plant, then it starts to become dangerous. So that's where we have the potential to save ourselves, right?
Yep, thank you, yes.
So I have a question. You mentioned the Jeopardy game where Watson... This natural language processor played humans, and it beat the humans, I think, fairly convincingly. But it got one question completely wrong, and I don't know if you remember that question because it relates here to Chicago. The question was about name an American airport that's named after an American Second World War fighter ace and a battle of the Second World War, and it gave the answer Toronto. I don't know if you remember that, and everyone gasped because the answer obviously is here in Chicago. O'Hare, Chuck O'Hare, and Midway. And so it was using all these processing, but it came up with an absurd answer. So I don't know whether you've looked at why it probably did its search and found out there was a Second World War pilot living near Toronto or something. It probably had some reason for it, but humans could tell immediately it was an absurd answer. So is there a way, does that contradict anything you've said? Is there a way of somehow shortcutting through these complicated inference systems to touch something that humans know for sure?
Well, Watson uses some of the techniques of logic programming only on the natural language parsing side, but not for the reasoning or knowledge representation side. So it uses associations which are statistical, like Google. When you do a keyword search on Google, it doesn't really understand what you want to know. It just looks at statistical frequencies and correlations. So that's why. But nonetheless, they're extremely powerful, and that's one of the reasons why things can get messy at the moment, because these AI systems, most of them are based on Bayesian network associations in particular, which don't have a logical interpretation, but which could be given a logical interpretation. So if we're going to control and understand these machines and benefit from their knowledge as for our own uses as well, they need to be reprogrammed in effect, so that the knowledge is not in the form of Bayesian associations, but rather logical relationships which may have probabilities associated with them. So Watson is not the kind of machine I've been talking about.
So first, hand for Dr. Kowalski.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and then be back in 11:15.